I really encourage people to look at the latest video I posted late last night on the crazy behavior of the jet streams, which I don't think we've had before.
Okay. Well, that's going to have to do it. Thank you so much for being with us, Paul Beckwith.
Okay, thank you. And I apologize for the time mix-up.
No problem. And thank you all for listening. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to be a founding sponsor of the Waterfront Blues Festival, the hallmark event for the Oregon Food Bank. Once again, with our partners at Oregon Community Media, KBOO will be broadcasting the four-day festival in the Portland metro area, across the state from Astoria to Ashland, and from Andrews to Antelope, and around the world at KBOO.fm. Remember to support your local food bank as you tune in to your community radio station, KBOO Portland, to enjoy the 29th annual Waterfront Blues Festival.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Soul City Supper Club concert series on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater in Portland. This month features local soul artist Ronnie Wright with new vocal diva Tamara Stevens and surprise guests from the Bespeak Project. The event will also have guest DJs, door prizes, and more. Again, that's the Soul City Supper Club concert series with Ronnie Wright and Tamara Stevens on Saturday, July 2nd at the Star Theater, 13 Northwest 6th Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning, it's 9:01. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. And here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. First, at the top of the hour, is that now. Political Perspectives, today featuring an interview with professor, activist, and writer Rebecca Gordon, author of American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. At 9:30, we feature our annual broadcast of the 1989 radio documentary Remembering Stonewall. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15 on Flashpoints, dreamer Jesus Guzman talks about the Dreamers, immigration abuse, and this week's Supreme Court decision. Also, the nephew of slain Honduran activist Berta Cáceres speaks out. At 11 o'clock on the radio zine, SW Concer speaks with documentary producer and investigative journalist Brill Curtis about the role of broadcast media in education, the exposés of government surveillance by Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks, and the challenges and opportunities for investigative reporting in the digital age. All that coming up on KBOO this morning. And thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. You're not a current member? You can fix that right now by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And here we go with Political Perspectives and activist and writer Rebecca Gordon.
TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. American Nuremberg. The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. An interview with Rebecca Gordon. Rebecca Gordon writes that for the sake of the victims of the war on terror, we need real accountability for American war criminals. Her book, American Nuremberg, published by Hot Books at Skyhorse, New York City, went into distribution in April 2016. If you are a longtime listener to TUC Radio, you occasionally hear rebroadcasts of programs produced by my colleague, Jeffrey Blankford. He's a well-known photographer, longtime activist, and host of a radio program on foreign policy, Takes on the World. In June 2016, he interviewed our mutual friend, Rebecca Gordon, on KZYX Radio in Philo, California.
It's my great pleasure to welcome Rebecca Gordon once again to Takes on the World. Jeffrey, it's a joy to be with you.
Your book really, really impressed me and was so timely. And it begins with an eloquent moving forward of how you came to write American Nuremberg. And I'd like you to share some of that with our listeners.
I was just hanging out in my usual life, teaching ethics to young people, when I got an email last March from David Talbot, who is the author, many people probably know him best as the author of Season of the Witch. So this is a well-known book. So David Talbot is also one of the original founders of Salon.com. So I had certainly heard of him, and this email arrived in my mailbox saying, I want you to write a book, and here's the title, American Nuremberg. And I was thrilled to have somebody actually ask me to write a book, but I was not happy with the title. And the reason why is that I'm a child of the 1950s. My parents lived through World War II. My father was raised in an Orthodox Jewish home in Norfolk, Virginia. And I grew up understanding that really, if there was one symbol of the depth of evil to which human beings could fall, it was the barbarism that enveloped Europe, that supposedly civilized continent, in the mid-20th century that began with the Nazis. That was the Nazi rise to power, the Holocaust. At the end of World War II, somewhere between 65 and 80 million people around the world had died. And so, terrible as I think the crimes that my country has committed in this so-called war on terror, they are nothing on the same scale as the crimes that people were put on trial for at Nuremberg. And so for people who might not remember, Nuremberg is the name of a city in Germany, and it's the place where the four victors in World War II, that would be Great Britain, France, the United States, and the Soviet Union, came together to put on trial a number up to, in the end, 200 high officials in the German Nazi government and some of the people in civilian life who had assisted them. But the most famous trials were the first ones, in which 22 people were put on trial. 19 of them were convicted. 3 of them were acquitted. And this is what we mean when we say Nuremberg. And it was the first time something really important historically happened at Nuremberg. It was really the first time in human history that internationally the nations of the world came together and said the actions of the people leading this particular nation have violated the laws and customs of war. They are wrong. And rather than simply taking what was called victor's justice, in other words, just lining up against a wall and shooting them, they said, we are going to actually put together a tribunal. We're going to put together a trial. We're going to have rules. We're going to have specific crimes that people are being tried for. They're going to have defense attorneys. We're going to have prosecutors. And we are going to put the international mark on justice and say international law is real law. And when you break international law on a scale like this, there are real consequences. So I came to be more comfortable with the title American Nuremberg, which is about people in the U.S. government who are responsible for 3 different kinds of crimes, which I can talk about in a minute, in this thing that seems to be this never-ending war on terror.
Well, it was actually, what didn't Dick Cheney call it, enduring freedom?
Enduring freedom, right. Enduring freedom to have surveillance, enduring freedom to have your email and your internet activity and your phone calls monitored, enduring freedom to destroy nation after nation after nation. So, you know, let's count them up. There's Afghanistan to start with, which, by the way, did not attack us on September 11th, although there were people who were part of Al-Qaeda, which was responsible for attacking us on September 11th, including the head of their organization, Osama bin Laden, who were resident in Afghanistan. There were actually offers to turn them over to the U.S. in return for certain things, but the U.S. preferred a military response. So, Afghanistan. Then there was Iraq, then there was Libya, and now, although we didn't start the civil war in Syria, we are certainly helping it to continue. And we should not forget the country of Yemen, where the United States is currently involved in a war with our ally Saudi Arabia. And this is particularly ironic because in Yemen, we are essentially fighting on the same side as Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula against a group of tribal people called the Houthi, who happen to be Shia Muslims, as opposed to Al-Qaeda and Saudi Arabia, where the vast majority of people are Sunni Muslims. So the U.S. has responded to one set of terrible attacks with wars in multiple countries on multiple continents. And I think that the people who are responsible for this, and of course for what we call extraordinary rendition, basically kidnapping people and sending them to other countries to be tortured, or kidnapping people and torturing them ourselves, I believe that these things are various kinds of really important crimes, and that those crimes, there needs to be justice for those crimes.
There has hardly been an anti-war movement protesting them, but before the war there was a significant movement. And the irony, of course, is the protest was exemplified by electing Barack Obama to the presidency and sweeping Democrats into the control of both the Senate and the House. But immediately Barack Obama said that instead of looking backward, we are going to look forward. And Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, also said essentially the same thing. And instead of having an investigation, even a minimum investigation like Britain did about its role getting into the Iraq War, nothing happened here. There was something that took place in a basement in Washington. But in terms of public demand for an accounting, it didn't happen.
No, that's absolutely right. And so the day that he came into office, President Obama signed executive orders that closed the CIA's black sites. This is what they call them. These were the secret torture centers that they had in Thailand and Poland, Romania, on the British island of Diego Garcia. They also had their own black site that was separate from the military, from the Defense Department in Guantanamo, in Guantanamo Bay. And he ordered those closed. And he also ordered that the use of what they called enhanced interrogation techniques, what ordinary people with an ordinary dictionary would call torture, that those should end. But you're exactly right. At the same time, he made this public announcement that we need to look forwards, not backwards. Now, my personal belief, and this is, I don't have a lot of evidence or any really to back this up, but I think that one thing that happened is that when he came into office, he also discovered the power of a permanent national security establishment, a national security state, and that there were limits to the power even of the President of the United States in facing that establishment, and that this was something of a quid pro quo, that yes, the CIA would agree to shut down these places and stop torturing people if they really did it. And, you know, we only have their word for it, but we can hope. And in return, there would be no prosecutions. And I think also, to be perfectly fair, that part of what he discovered was not only there are limits to the presidency, but those limits are much greater when the president happens to be a black man. Nonetheless, the result has been that nobody has been prosecuted. Nobody has been held accountable in any public way for a series of different kinds of crimes. And in the book, I divide them into three sort of categories, kind of following what they did at Nuremberg. So the first one is war crimes. And that's something that the world was familiar with. There was already a big body of international law and custom about how wars should be conducted, what kinds of things violated that, including ways that prisoners couldn't be treated and so forth. But the other two categories were new. One of them is called crimes against humanity. And those are crimes that are committed in the context of a war, in the context of also committing war crimes, which involve the elimination, the destruction, or the mass deportation or movement of an entire group of people based on ethnicity, like the Jews, based on level of physical or mental ability, like disabled people, based on sexual orientation, like the LGBT people who were also killed by the Nazis, or the Roma people who were also killed by the Nazis. These were the crimes against humanity. But the United States and Britain argued very forcefully for the first crime, the crime that they said was the root of all the other crimes, and a lot of people don't remember this, which was the crime against peace. In other words, the idea that if you have international law against invading another country, and if you have, as Germany had and as the U.S. has, signed a treaty saying you will not invade another country unless you have been first attacked by that country, that crime against peace, that creating the initial war, was what the British and the Americans argued was the wellspring of all the other crimes. And we forget, we think, you know, Nazi Germany, the Holocaust, but most of the people who died in the Holocaust didn't die inside Germany. They died in occupied Poland. So it's the invasion of Austria, of Poland, of Czechoslovakia that begins all the rest of the crimes. You can't have war crimes without a war. And so as I was thinking about how the U.S. has behaved since September 11th, since those terrible attacks, one of the things that I realized is that we have been horrified, and properly so, and I wrote a whole book about it, by the torture that the U.S. has been involved in. And, you know, we had had a period since the end of the Vietnam War in which we more or less believed about ourselves that that's something we don't do. We may teach other countries how to do it at the School of the Americas, but we don't do it ourselves. And that, of course, all changed after September 11th. So we've really been focused on the torture, which is terrible. But we missed the bigger crime. And the crime that really, in the beginning, was responsible for the torture, and that's the invasion of Iraq. And the reason I say that is, when they first started torturing people, the very first people who were waterboarded, the very first people who were given the treatment that Donald Rumsfeld approved in Guantanamo, that included sleep deprivation, stress positions, using dogs to terrify people, all of those kinds of things, those were all for the purpose of getting somebody somewhere to say that Saddam Hussein was in some way in cahoots with al-Qaeda, and that Saddam Hussein, the then head of the Iraqi government, was responsible for September 11th. And of course, it wasn't true. But they took a man named Abu Zubaydah. They exposed him to what they call the waterboard. And, you know, waterboarding has been described in the media as simulated drowning. But there's nothing simulated about it. It's plain old drowning. And they did this to him 83 times. Well, you do that to anyone, and they'll tell you whatever it is you want to hear. And by the way, this Abu Zubaydah is a very interesting story. He's actually from Saudi Arabia. He is the person that every time somebody said, well, why do you have to do this torture? Why do you have to use these enhanced interrogation techniques? This was the man that Donald Rumsfeld turned to, that George W. Bush turned to, that Dick Cheney turned to, and said, see, this is why. So Donald Rumsfeld said he was the number two man, or very close to the number two man, in al-Qaeda. George W. Bush said he was one of Osama bin Laden's top lieutenants. Later on, Bush also added, and Cheney went along with this, that he was running a training camp in Afghanistan where five of the original hijackers on September 11th were trained. So this was one of the really bad guys, as Bush used to like to say, and they had to torture him because he was so bad. Well, it turns out the main reason they were torturing him was to get him to say something about Saddam Hussein. But it also turns out that none of this was true. The prime example of why they had to torture, it was all lies. And in fact, it's true. He did run a training camp in Afghanistan because he was a CIA asset when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan in the 1980s. He was training the Mujahideen, who were the Islamic fighters who were trying to throw out the Soviet Union occupation. He was one of Ronald Reagan's freedom fighters. And of course, the Mujahideen eventually became the Taliban that the U.S. declared war on. And the Taliban ran Afghanistan in a horrible way, and it was particularly horrible for women. And I hold no brief for the Taliban, but they were actually the legitimate, at one time, U.S.-supported government of Afghanistan when we attacked them. So he had run this camp. The camp was called Khaldun. And here's how the CIA did the logical loop. Because he was running this camp, and he was known to be a lieutenant of Al-Qaeda, then Khaldun must be an Al-Qaeda training camp. Because he ran an Al-Qaeda training camp, he must be a high member of Al-Qaeda. So it was a complete logical circle that wasn't true. So the reason we know it's not true is that in 2009, now under the Obama administration, Abu Zubaydah's lawyers were presenting a case for what's called habeas corpus. That basically means, hey, government, you have this person's body. Tell us why you are holding him. So they have been suing the government for years to find out why he was being held in Guantanamo. Because once the CIA was done with him, they shipped him off to Guantanamo with a memo saying he should never again in his life have substantial or substantive contact with a human being, that he should be kept incommunicado for the rest of his life. So his lawyers are trying to find out, well, what did he do? So in the process, they're saying, well, you're claiming that he did this, you know, that he was a Al-Qaeda lieutenant, that he trained these people for 9/11, that maybe he knew something about the Millennium Bomb plot in 2000, that he helped Osama bin Laden escape from Afghanistan. You're claiming all of this. Show us the papers. Show us the proof. And so the government filed a brief in reply in which they said, we don't have to show you any papers because guess what? We're no longer claiming that he was in Al-Qaeda. We're no longer claiming that he was ever even a member of Al-Qaeda. We're no longer claiming that he ran an Al-Qaeda training camp. We're no longer claiming that he had anything to do with September 11th. So they withdrew every single reason why they're holding him, and yet the case drags on, and he is still in Guantanamo. So all of which is to say that the crime, the birth crime, if you will, was the desire to invade Iraq. And in fact, Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and his neoconservative cabal came into the White House with a plan to do exactly that. It's the same plan that they had tried to sell back in 1992 to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel, and it was called A Clean Break. And then they formed an organization, and there were about 20 of these people, including Khalilzad and Elliot Abrams, who some of you may remember from Central America days, and Paul Wolfowitz, and they...
Don't forget Richard Pearl.
Right, absolutely, Richard Pearl.
The Black Prince.
And they brought a whole bunch of these people. Dick Cheney brought them along with him into the White House, and they tried to sell the same plan to Bill Clinton in 1996 under the guise of an organization called the Project for a New American Century. And the plan was basically a plan to destabilize and then remake the Middle East along lines that would be more in keeping with U.S. strategic interests. So the first step was get rid of Saddam Hussein and open up the Iraqi oil fields to U.S. oil companies. Next was destabilize Syria, replace the Assad regime. In those days, it was Bashar Assad's father, but replace the Assad regime with somebody that we like better. Now, we liked Assad well enough to send him a Canadian named Maher Arar in 2003 to be tortured for 10 months. But nonetheless, we suddenly woke up one day and discovered that he runs a police state, which is true. And so we're definitely against Assad now. Destabilize Syria, and then eventually go on to Jordan. Libya was sort of on the side there. But the idea was that we would remake the whole Arab world along lines that were more, oh, and Iran, of course, that were, so not just the Arab world, but the whole Middle East, along lines that would more appeal to U.S. interests. Well, I got to say, these guys were not only pernicious and determined, and they discussed these plans way back in March of 2001, long before September 11th. They were not only determined, but they were stupid. Because the end result is, yeah, they've remade the Middle East into chaos, but the U.S. oil companies didn't end up with most of the contracts in the Iraqi oil fields. So they didn't even get one of their, but not their only, prime objectives. So people don't remember, because September 11th came along and kind of wiped our memories. But way back in March of 2001, the big issue in the country was that Dick Cheney had been put in charge of creating the new energy policy for the United States. And this was the big job that George W. Bush gave him. And he was meeting with all these people. He was holding meetings, secret meetings, in the White House, and nobody could get him to say who he was meeting with to formulate our new energy policy. And in fact, he claimed executive privilege and said, I don't have to tell you who. And CEOs of oil companies went up on to Congress, to Capitol Hill, and perjured themselves and said they hadn't met with Dick Cheney when they had met with him 50 times. And what they were doing was laying out the plan to invade Iraq. And so on September 12th, 2001, the day after the attacks, we already see memos from Dick Cheney saying, is there any way we can pin this on Saddam Hussein? So they were already preparing this war that had nothing to do with September 11th, that had nothing to do with any kind of international law, that was in fact a violation of laws and treaties that the United States has signed. And by the way, in the U.S. Constitution, which some of us still fondly remember, in Article 6, it says, if we sign and the Senate ratifies a treaty, that treaty becomes part of the supreme law of the land. It's as if it were any other federal law. It has to be obeyed. That includes the Kellogg-Briand Treaty that we signed way back in 1928, saying we wouldn't attack people who didn't attack us. It also includes the Charter for the United Nations, of which the U.S. is, of course, a founding member and a permanent member on the Security Council. So it includes a lot of treaties. It also, of course, includes the Convention Against Torture, which we signed and ratified. So here's the problem. The right place for these people to be tried is either in U.S. courts or the International Criminal Court. But the U.S. is not part of the International Criminal Court. We love it when they try African leaders there, but under Bush, they actually withdrew the signature, and Congress passed a law making it illegal for anybody to assist the trying of any U.S. person in the International Criminal Court. So that's out. In fact, they even said that if somebody is on trial there, the Army should go in and rescue them. Some people called it the Invade the Hague Law. So that's out. The chances that we're going to see prosecutions here in the United States, there are plenty of things they could do. The likelihood that Hillary Clinton or, God knows, Donald Trump is going to do that are very, very slim, in fact, nil. So in a way, that kind of throws it back on us. And I look back to the model that Jean-Paul Sartre and Bertrand Russell in Europe did in 1967 when they tried the United States government in a people's tribunal for war crimes in the Vietnam War. And these were held over a series of days in Europe. I think what we need is a people's tribunal. And I think we need to bring together people, ideally people of a variety of political stripes, but who believe in the rule of law, as I do, and people who have been victims of the war on terror in various ways, and to have a serious airing. Because the people I know who work with victims of torture and war especially, all of them say that the number one thing that people want in order to feel that they have had justice is for their story to be heard and publicly acknowledged. And so I think that if we can't get an official government acknowledgement, we need a people's acknowledgement of what has been done and sadly is still being done in our names as the people of this still nominally democratic country.
That was Rebecca Gordon, author of American Nuremberg, The U.S. Officials Who Should Stand Trial for Post-9/11 War Crimes. The book was published by Skyhorse New York via its imprint, Hot Books. Rebecca Gordon teaches philosophy at the University of San Francisco. Her prior book, Mainstreaming Torture, was based on her PhD thesis in ethics and social theory at the GTU, the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. Rebecca Gordon was interviewed by activist, photographer, and radio host Jeffrey Blankford on June 22, 2016. And my thanks go out to my friends Rebecca and Jeffrey and to KZYX Radio in Philo, California, for this extraordinary interview. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. Look for the newest programs page. TUC Radio is free and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation keeps this program on the air. Go to TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org, for the address and donate buttons. There you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for listening to KBOO. Stay tuned at 10 for Air Cascadia. For now, it's our annual broadcast of the 1989 radio documentary Remembering Stonewall. Stay tuned.
Today, this white, two-story building across from Sheridan Square in Greenwich Village is a clothing store and a closed Chinese restaurant. 20 years ago, this was the Stonewall Inn. I'm Michael Shirker, and I'm working on the first comprehensive history of the Stonewall riots. In 1969, the Stonewall was one of the most popular gay bars in New York City, and, like all other gay bars, was routinely raided by the Vice Squad. The patrons of these bars, many of whom were frightened at having their identities revealed, would quietly submit to any orders coming from the police. Yet, on June 27th, 1969, that all changed. The patrons of this bar, with the drag queens at the forefront, decided to fight back against the police. What happened here on that night would spark a revolution.
I am Gene Harwood, and my age is 80.
I'm Bruce Merrill.
He also would like to know what your age is. So you
my
tell
age,
him your age.
78. Mm-hmm. Yes.
I don't know if it's really true, but now people do refer to us as the two oldest gay men in America. We do, I think, have maybe a record relationship of almost 60 years together. Bruce's memory started. Going bad in 1984. Fortunately, we have our music together, which we've done over the years. We've written any number of songs. Bruce remembers the melodies very well and the lyrics for the songs.
When you touched me, when you took my hand, something happened I had never planned.
Being gay before Stonewall was a very difficult proposition because we felt that in order to survive, we had to try to look and act as straight as possible. The general attitude of society as far as employers were concerned and landlords, all of these people were very hostile, and to protect ourselves, we had to act as rugged and manly as possible to get by in
my name is
in
Randy Wicker.
I was
the first openly gay person to appear on radio in 1962 and on television in 1964 as a self-identified homosexual. In the era before Stonewall, people felt a need to hide because of the precarious legal position they were in. They would lose their jobs. There was a great hostility, socially speaking, in the sense of people found out you were gay, they assumed you were a communist or a child molester or any of another dozen stereotypes that were rampant in the public media at the time.
I'm Jerry Fair, and I'm 80 years old. I started a gay lifestyle in 1948, when I was around 39 or 40. At that time, if there was even a suspicion that you were gay, that you were a lesbian, you were fired from your job, and you were in such a position of disgrace that you slunk out without saying goodbye even to the people that liked you and you liked, never even bothered to clean your desk. You just disappeared. You just disappeared. You went quietly because you were afraid that the recriminations that would come if you even stood there and protested would be worse than just leaving.
My name is Sylvia Rivera. My name before that was Ray Rivera until I started dressing in drag in 1961. The era before Stonewall was a hard era. There was always the gay bashings on the drag queens by heterosexual men, women, and the police. We learned to live with it because it was part of the lifestyle at that time, I guess. But none of us were very happy about it.
My name is Seymour Pine. In 1968, I was assigned as deputy inspector in charge of public morals in the first division in the police department, which covered South Manhattan from 38th Street to the Battery, including the Greenwich Village area. It was the duty of public morals to enforce all laws concerning vice and gambling, including prostitution, narcotics, and laws and regulations concerning homosexuality. The part of the penal code which applied to drag queens was section 240.35, section 4. Being masked or in any manner disguised by unusual or unnatural attire or facial alteration, loiters, remains, or congregates in a public place.
At that time, we lived at the Arista Hotel. We sit around, just try to figure out when this harassment would come to an end. And we would always dream that one day it would come to an end. And we prayed and we looked for it. We wanted to be human beings.
My name is Red Mahoney. I've been hanging out, drinking, partying, and working in the gay bars for the last 30 years. In the era before Stonewall, all of the bars, 90% of the bars, were mafia controlled. They were controlled because the mafia had the right connections. There wasn't that many gay bars. You'd have maybe one, two uptown on the Upper East Side. They would get closed down, and there'd be one or two on the West Side. They'd get closed down, and midtown there'd be one, two, three maybe open. As they would get closed down, they'd move around, and they were dumps.
I'm Joan Nessel, co-founder of what is now the largest collection of lesbian culture in the world. The police raided lesbian bars regularly, and they both did it in the most obvious way, which was hauling women away in paddy wagons, but there was regular weekend harassment, which would consist of the police coming in regularly to get their payoffs. And in the Sea Colony, we had a back room with a red light, and when that red light went on, it meant the police would be arriving in around 10 minutes. And so we all had to sit down at our tables. And we would be sitting there almost like school children. And the cops would come in. Now, depending on who was on, which cop was on, if it was some that really resented the butch women, who were with many times very beautiful women, we knew we were in for it, because what would happen is they would start harassing one of these women and saying, "Hi, you think you're a man? Come outside, we'll show you." And the woman would be dragged away, they throw up against a wall, and they'd say, "So you think you're a man? Let's see what you got in your pants." And they would put their hand down her pants.
The stone wall. Oh, that was a good bar. That was. Just to get into the stone wall, you'd walk up and you'd knock on the front door. You'd knock and the little door would open and, "Hey, what do you want?" "A Mary sent me." "Good. Come on in, girls." You know, when you walked in, to your right was your bar room, no windows. Down at the far end of the bar was an opening in the wall going into the dance room with the jukebox in that room, and no windows in that room either. The stone wall, like all gay bars at that time, were painted black. Charcoal black. And what was the funny part? The place would be so dimly lit, but as soon as the cops were gonna come in to collect their percentage or whatever they were coming in for, from it being a nice, dimly lit dump, the place was lit up like Luna Park.
You felt, well, two guys, and that's very often all we sent in would be two men, could handle 200 people. I mean, you tell them to leave, and they leave, and you say, "Show me your identification," and they all take out their identification and file out, and that's it, and you say, "Okay, you're not a man, you're a woman, or you're vice versa, and you wait over there." I mean, this is a kind of power that you have, and you never gave it a second thought.
The drag queen took a lot of oppression, and we had to... We were at a point where I guess nothing would have stopped us. I guess, as they say, or as Shakespeare says, we were ladies in waiting, just waiting for the thing to happen. And when it did happen, we were there.
On Friday night, June 27th, 1969, at about 11:45, eight officers from Public Morals 1st Division loaded into four unmarked police cars. From their headquarters on 21st Street and 3rd Avenue, they headed downtown and then west towards the Stonewall Inn here at 7th Avenue and Christopher Street. It was the second time the bar was raided that week. The local 6th Precinct had just received a new commanding officer who kicked off his tenure by initiating a series of raids on gay bars. And New York was in the midst of a mayoral campaign, always a bad time for homosexuals. Mayor John Lindsay had good reason to agree to the police crackdown. He had just lost his party's primary and needed a popularity boost. And the Stonewall Inn was indeed an inviting target. Operated by the Gambino crime family without a liquor license, this dance bar drew a crowd of drag queens, hustlers, minors, and more masculine lesbians known as bull dykes. Many were black or Hispanic. It was a warm night in New York City and a somber day for many. Judy Garland, who had died earlier in the week, was buried that morning. It was almost precisely at midnight that the Moral Squad pulled up to the Stonewall Inn, led by Deputy Inspector Seymour Pine.
There was never any reason to feel that anything of any unusual situation would occur that night.
You could actually feel it in the air. You really could. I guess Judy Garland's death just really helped us really hit the fan.
For some reason, things were different this night. As we were bringing the prisoners out, they were resisting.
People started gathering in front of the Sheridan Square Park right across the street from Stonewall. People were upset. "No, we're not going to go." And people started screaming and hollering.
One drag queen, as we put her in the car, opened the door on the other side and jumped out, at which time we had to chase that person. And he was caught, put back into the car. He made another attempt to get out the same door, the other door. And at that point, we had to handcuff the person. From this point on, things really began to get crazy.
My name is Robert Rivera, and my nickname is Birdie, and I've been cross-dressing all of my life. I remember the night of the riots. The police were escorting the queens out of the bar and into the paddy wagon. And there was this one particularly outrageously beautiful queen with stacks and stacks of Elizabeth Taylor style hair. And she was asking them not to push her. And they continued to push her, and she turned around and she mashed the cop with her high heel. She knocked him down, and then she proceeded to frisk him for the keys to the handcuffs that were on him. She got them, and she undid herself and passed them to another queen that was behind her.
Well, that's when all hell broke loose at that point. And then we had to get back into the Stonewall.
My name is Howard Smith. On the night of the Stonewall riots, I was a reporter for the Village Voice, locked inside with the police, covering it for my column. It really did appear that crowd, because we could look through little peepholes in the plywood windows, we could look out, and we could see that the crowd, well, my guess was within 5-10 minutes, it was probably several thousand people. Now, 2,000, easy. And they were yelling, "Kill the cops. Police brutality. Let's get them. We're not going to take this anymore. Let's get them."
We noticed a group of persons attempting to uproot one of the parking meters, in which they did succeed. And they then used that parking meter to as a battering ram to break down the door. And they did, in fact, open the door. They crashed it in, and at that point was when they began throwing Molotov cocktails into the place. It was a situation that we didn't know how we were going to be able to control.
I remember someone throwing a Molotov cocktail. I don't know who the person was, but I mean, I saw that, and I just said to myself in Spanish, I said, "Oh my God, the revolution is finally here." And I just like started screaming, "Freedom, we're free at last," you know, and it felt really good.
There were a couple of cops stationed on either side of the door with their pistols, like in a combat stance, aimed in the door area. A couple others were stationed in other places, behind like a pole, another one behind the bar. All of them with their guns ready. I don't think up to that point I had ever seen cops that scared.
Remember, these were pros, but everybody was frightened. There's no question about that. I know I was frightened. And I'd been in combat situations, and there was never any time that I felt more scared than I felt that night. And, I mean, it was just, you know, there was no place to run.
When the Morrill Squad officers barricaded themselves inside the Stonewall, Deputy Inspector Pine put in a 1041 call, an emergency help request which can only be placed by a high-ranking officer. That call was mysteriously canceled, and the telephone inside the Stonewall went dead. It took nearly 45 minutes for the riot police to get to the Stonewall and rescue the Morrill Squad from the smoldering bar.
Once the tactical police force showed up, I think that really incited us a little bit more.
My name is Martin Boyce. In 1969, I was a drag queen known as Miss Martin. I remember on that night, when we saw the riot police, all of us drag queens, we linked arms like the Rockettes and sang the song we used to sing. "We are the village girls. We wear our hair in curls. We wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees." And the police went crazy hearing that, and they just immediately rushed us. We gave one kick and fled.
My name is Rudy. And the night of the Stonewall, I was 18. And to tell you the truth, that night I was doing more running than fighting. I remember looking back from 10th Street. And there on Waverly Street, there was a police, I believe, on his cop, and is on his stomach in his tactical uniform and his helmet and everything else, with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe. Whether it was a high heel or not, I don't know. But she was beating the hell out of him. It was hysterical.
My name is Mama Jean. I'm a lesbian. And I guess you would label me as a butch. I remember on that night, I was in a gay bar, a women's bar, called Cookies. We were coming out of the gay bar, going toward 8th Street. And that's when we saw everything happen. Blasting away, people getting beat up, police coming from every direction, hitting women as well as men with their nightsticks. Gay men running down the street with blood all over their face. We decided right then and there, whether we were scared or not, we didn't think about it. We just jumped in.
But here, this queen is going completely bananas, you know, jumping and hitting the windshield. And next thing you know, the taxi cab was being turned over, or the cars were being turned over, things. Windows were shattering all over the place. Wires were burning around the place. It was beautiful. It really was.
I remember one cop coming at me, hitting me with the nightstick in the back of my legs. I broke loose and I went after him. I grabbed his nightstick. My girlfriend went behind him. She was a strong 7 again. I wanted him to feel the same pain I felt. And I kept on saying to him, "How do you like the pain? Do you like it? Do you like it?" And I kept on hitting him and hitting him. I was angry. I wanted to kill him. At that particular minute, I wanted to kill him.
I wanted to do every destructive thing that I could think of at that time to hurt anyone that had hurt us through the years.
It's like just when you see a man protecting his own life. They weren't the queens that people call them. They were men fighting for their lives. And I'd fight alongside them any day, no matter how old I was.
A lot of heads were bashed. But it didn't hurt their true feelings. They all came back for more. Nothing. That's when you could tell that nothing could stop us at that time, or at any time in the future.
The media covered the riot extensively. The Daily News featured it on its front page. There were reports on all the local television and radio stations. By the next day, graffiti calling for gay power had appeared on buildings and sidewalks all over the West Village. Hastily worked up flyers distributed on street corners touted the night as the hairpin drop heard round the world. And the next night, thousands of men and women converged on the West Village. They came here, back to the Stonewall, to see what would happen next. While trash cans were set on fire, stones were thrown, and sporadic fighting broke out between police and gays, the more than 400 riot police milling around the village ensured that the previous night's violence would not be repeated. But on this night, for the first time, gay couples could be seen walking hand in hand or kissing in the streets. Just by being there, surrounded by reporters and photographers and onlookers, thousands of men and women were proclaiming to themselves and the rest of the world that they were gay. And the crowds grew and came back the next night, and for one more night the following week. What happened here on those nights helped to usher in a new era, both personally and politically, for gay men and lesbians.
When Stonewall happened, Bruce and I were still in the closet, where we had been for nearly 40 years, but we realized that this was a tremendous thing that had happened at Stonewall, and it gave us a feeling that we were not going to be remaining closeted for very much longer. And soon thereafter, we did come out of the closet.
My name is Ginny Apuzzo. In 1969, I was in the convent. I was in the Sisters of Charity, and when Stonewall hit the press, it hit me with a bolt of lightning. It was as if I had an incredible release of my own outrage at having to sequester so much of my life. I made my way down. I seem to recall in subsequent nights being down on the, you know, kind of just in the periphery looking, observer, clearly an observer, clearly longing to have that courage to come out. And it was a matter, as I recall, it was only a matter of weeks before I left the convent and started a new life.
I'm Henry Baird. In 1969, I was in the U.S. Army, a Specialist 3 stationed at Long Binh Post near Saigon in Vietnam. I remember I was having lunch in the Army mess, reading the Armed Forces news summary of the day. And there was a short paragraph describing a riot led by homosexuals in Greenwich Village against the police. and my heart was filled with joy. I thought about what I had read frequently, but I had no one to discuss it with. And secretly within myself, I decided that when I came back stateside, if I should survive to come back stateside, I would come out as a gay person. And I did.
For those of us in public morals, after the Stonewall incident, things were completely changed from what they had previously been. They suddenly were not submissive anymore. They now suddenly had gained a new type of courage. And it seemed as if they didn't care anymore about whether they were whether their identities were made known. We were now dealing with human beings.
My name is Jim Forat, and I'm in the mid-60s, along with Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. I was one of the founders of the Yippie movement. I remember on the third night of the riots, there was this meeting called by Mattachine Society at St. John's Church on Waverly Place. We went, and Randy Wicker was running the meeting.
For 10 years, I've been going on television as Randy Wicker, the respectable homosexual dressed in dark suit and tie, explaining to people that most homosexuals look like everybody else and behave like everybody else. And when Stonewall began happening, you had chorus lines of queens kicking their heels up at the police, and bonfires burning in the corner trash baskets and throwing bricks and stones at the police. I was horrified because this violated everything that we thought of as responsible behavior, that this was not the way respectable citizens behaved.
Evelyn Hooker was a sociologist, I believe. Randy had introduced her, and she got up and she suggested that we should have a candlelight march, that we should turn the other cheek because gay people were really different, we were really nice, and we had to show how nice we were and stop all this rioting because people were going to get hurt. I remember I stood up and I said, no, we are not going back. And people felt the same thing I felt. And we marched out of that room, and that was the night that the Gay Liberation Front was born.
Today, I live in a senior citizen apartment building. What's different now is that I can be free. I have a daughter who's a senior citizen, and my son is 58. They know about my homosexuality. My three grandchildren in their 30s know about their grandmother. I have a great-granddaughter who at the age of 10 learned that Grandma Jerry was a lesbian, and she thought that was most interesting. And yet I still don't have the personal courage to not care if these yentas in the building know that Jerry's a lesbian.
Well, I retired from the police department in 1976. 20 years have passed. I'm going to be 70 in a few months. I still don't know the answers. I would still like to know the answer. I would like to know whether I was wrong or whether I was right in ever thinking that there was a difference, and ever thinking that maybe you shouldn't trust a homosexual because something is missing in his personality.
The archives of lesbian culture, which surrounds us now and was created 4 years after Stonewall, owes, at least for my part, its creation to that night and the courage that found its voice in the streets. That night, in some very deep way, we finally found our place in history. Not as a dirty joke, not as a doctor's case study, not as a freak, but as a people. Imagine myself
away from you. Remembering Stonewall was engineered by Spider Blue. It was produced by David Isay with a grant from the Pacifica National Program Fund. I'm Michael Shirker.
Today I'm a 38-year-old drag queen. I can keep my long hair, I can pluck my eyebrows, and I can work wherever the hell I want. And I'm not going to change for anybody. If I change, then I feel that I'm losing what 1969 brought into my life. And that was to be totally free.
How can I ever close the door and be the same as I was before? Darling, no, no, I can't anymore. It's too late now.
That was Remembering Stonewall. It's a documentary produced by David Isay in 1989 and originally broadcast in the 20th anniversary of the Stonewall Rebellion. It is the first documentary in any medium about the uprising. And the time is 9:59 here at KBOO Portland. Stay tuned at 10:15 for Flashpoints today on the program. Dreamer Jesus Guzman talks about the Dreamers, immigration abuse, and this week's Supreme Court decision. Also, the nephew of slain Honduran activist Berta Cáceres speaks out. And at 11 o'clock on the Radio Zine, SW Concert speaks with documentary producer and investigative journalist Bill Curtis about the role of broadcast media in the education, the exposés of government surveillance by Edward Snowden and WikiLeaks, and the challenges and opportunities for investigative reporting in the digital age. And immediately following the next announcement, stay tuned for Air Cascadia. Thanks for tuning into KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Green Day's American Idiot, produced by Triangle Productions. The two-time Tony Award-winning hit follows Johnny, Toonie, and Will as they flee the constraints of their hometown for the thrills of the city life in this energy-fueled rock opera. That's American Idiot, June 9th through July 2nd at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.